started, just a couple of notes for those that might not have attended the committee of the whole before. One of the things we're talking about doing routinely is just moving the committee of the whole meetings to the council chambers, primarily so that we have greater seating and we have the ability for people to hear better. So this might be something you see going forward. Keep in mind, though, this is still considered a working meeting for the council. We ask staff for questions, commentary, and we'll have certain presentations. But we don't take votes during this meeting, nor do we allow public input. So if we don't call on you, and we're not slighting you, it's just that we don't take public comment during or public testimony during these meetings. So with that in mind, our first item on the agenda is library services review. Audrey, you're going to step us through that?
Sure. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk about library services, and obviously we're thrilled that the timing is such that we get to talk about the National Medal. So we're thrilled and honored to be a National Medal winner. So there's 120,000 libraries in the United States, and there, in the history of the IMLS National Medal, there's only been 4 libraries in Minnesota that have won the award. And we're the only library in Minnesota to win. So this year, there are 10 medals given, 5 to libraries, 5 to museums, and we're one of those 5. And I want to thank you for your ongoing support. Without your ongoing support, we would not be able to be a national medal winner. So how did we get here? And I think it's really about how we plan. It's how we execute and connect with people, and it's how we evaluate. And I'll be talking a little bit about each of those steps. So we have done strategic planning for a long time at the library, but really in 2012 was where we swerved. And we used, at the time, the strategic planning for results that is a book put out by the Public Library Association. We used that as our framework to do our strategic planning. And it really, the way it involved the community really allowed us to do things differently. So instead of saying, what do you want the library to do, we really said to the community, what's your vision for the community? And they loudly said, workforce, education, being welcoming and inclusive. And so as we talked about that, we said, then what does that mean for the library? And the community, we had this great ongoing dialogue with a focus group that really helped us. And so the strategic planning process that's owned by the library board of community volunteers really helped us define, and there's really 3 goals. We need to grow literacy, we need to engage the community, and we need to build infrastructure to do the first 2. And so what I'll be talking about for the next bit is some of the things, I'm not going to try and give you everything in the kitchen sink here, just some highlights of some of the ways that we've changed over the years. And so how this connect part of the slide that you have is really about how we do it. And that's really where the rubber hits the road, is where team members come together with community partners to really create a great community and have the library be part of that. So under grown literacy, so back in 2012, we didn't really do much around basic literacy. But the focus group said to us, really, if education, workforce, and being welcoming and inclusive are top three and four community priorities, you can't do nothing around basic literacy. People who can't read can't get jobs. People who read struggle financially, or who can't read struggle financially, and they end up interacting with law enforcement more than people who do read. So what's our role? And so that's when we went out and talked to community partners and found our niche in the program called Rochester Reading Champions. That's where we partner highly trained community volunteers with underserved, struggling readers, both youth and adults. And we partner with the Reading Center. We also put the volunteers in places where those struggling readers already are. They're in the adult detention. They're at the Boys and Girls Club. They're, we partner with several of the schools. And we're at Hawthorne. And so those are... And we're seeing amazing results. We're seeing every single person in the program is making progress. And for those who completed the program, the kids are seeing a 2.5 grade increase. And some of our adults are seeing significantly higher than that. So another thing that we do under our Grow Literacy umbrella is our Cradle to Career work. I mean, it's why we're part of that Cradle to Career effort. The community is coming together around how do we improve educational outcomes, because we know that education is the best lever that we can use to improve people's health, to have people succeed in jobs, to have more people graduate from high school. And it affects everything within our community, and that's why the library is part of that effort, along with the city. The city is absolutely a partner as well. But it's not just what happens within the building, though that's certainly part of it. It's how we are out in the community as well. So we have a bookmobile. We have the busiest bookmobile in the state of Minnesota. We have mini libraries. We have over 190 mini libraries throughout our community. And we're out in the community doing programs and creating opportunities for people to connect. And our collections are changing as well. So as our world becomes more digitally connected, last year, in 1 year alone, we saw a 36% increase in digital downloads. And so we're having to purchase in that format, which we were the first library to add e-books in the state of Minnesota, but we continue to have pressure to continue to build that collection, and we're seeing that pay off in the usage around the community. And then there's engage the community, and why is that important? An engaged community participates more, they are more resilient. Ken Jones will be the first to tell you, people who are connected with each other rely on government less when they rely on each other. And people who are connected and belong to this community are less likely to move, and that helps us with workforce. So as part of our engagement, and then the focus group really told us that our role as community connector was really important. And so we have embraced that. And also embraced the part about being welcoming and inclusive. So we've listened to the community and said we need to create these safe places where the library is that safe place where people can come together. And an example of that is, as we listened to the community, they said we need a safe place to talk about LGBTQIA, where people can connect safely and be who they are. And we've embraced that. In fact, we have become a leader in the community of providing training for other youth-serving organizations and really embracing that. So we have a Q Club, we have Transforming Families, we have Parents in Power Pride, and embrace that safe space. I keep coming back to that strategic plan because it's been so important in who we are and who we are becoming. And as part of that, we have a summer playlist. So for years, we had a summer reading program, where it really focused on only reading. How many minutes did you read? That's what we were counting. And as we stepped back, the whole team of people who designed this program really looked at the whole strategic plan. How do we encourage our community members, all ages, not just kids, to embrace everything that the community said was important? So we designed a summer playlist program that encourages them to go out and meet a neighbor, to find a mini library, to do something creative, to try something new, as well as reading. And all of those things, we saw a 52% increase in participation for our summer reading program, the summer playlist. And I love this quote that came out of one of the surveys. It was broad enough to include children who struggle with reading but want to participate. It included both of my great nephews, one who is deaf and one who has ADHD. And that's part of being welcoming and inclusive. How do we design programs that really help everybody? Part of engaging is around civic engagement. So starting in June, we have a new program called We the People. And people in the community can get passports. They actually can put their picture in them. They get stamps for doing things that engage them within the community. Going to National Night Out, attending a debate, going to a neighborhood event. All of those things. It encourages people to participate in civic engagement, which is important for our community. And also our stories. So we got a grant from the Legacy Fund to actually put in a sound booth in the library, and we've started collecting oral histories. And how do we embrace our history and who we are as a community and keep those stories? And what I love about this, so that started in 2017, but as part of the National Medal, StoryCorps is coming to Rochester to collect more of our stories. And I just love how that is all dovetailing together. And so as we engage in that community, that place as connector, we've started something called speed friending. We know there are a lot of people who move in and out of Rochester who may or may not get connected, and we're creating those opportunities for people to just meet other people in a way that's different from work and different from hanging in a bar and those kinds of things. And so we have seen such a huge response to that, we've had to add more and more sessions there because they've actually been beyond our capacity. And so we also, Rochester is a community that was founded on innovation, and we continue to look for ways for people to be creative and to innovate, and we do that through things like the Art Cart. The Art Cart happens, actually was funded through, in 2015, the Book Bike won a local government innovation award, and with the money that we received from that award, we actually purchased the Art Cart, and now we're out all summer long encouraging creativity in the community. And then our third goal is around building infrastructure. So this last year, the Rochester Reading Champions program was so popular, and we were running out of space. And some of our partners at the Boys and Girls Club were using every nook and cranny you could possibly find after school. We actually, because more of the reference collection has gone digital, we actually downsized the reference collection and put in two tutoring rooms and space for collection to support the tutors. We're also trying to be creative around space. Tonight on the City Council agenda is a proposal to pilot library programming happening at the Mayo Civic Center. And so we're looking for ways to continue to maximize city space to create those opportunities for programming and engagement. And we look for the long-term conversations that will happen through your strategic planning, that how the library board and the city council can have the conversations about what's the future of the library. So back in 2016, as we were working on the expansion plan, the slide you have in front of you shows how we were tying every single space to our strategic plan. And it really was a strategic plan that was driving what kind of spaces are needed as we go forward into the future. And then building infrastructure. It's not just physical space, it's also about our digital infrastructure. Public libraries are the number one place that people without internet access go to get it. We have internet stations in the library, we have public Wi-Fi, but now, funded through the Rochester Public Library Foundation, we actually have Wi-Fi hotspots that people can check out and use, take those home and use them to apply for jobs, use them for kids to do homework, use ways to connect. But then how do we evaluate? And that has also been part of our journey. So it isn't like we just stopped in 2012 and said we're done. In 2015, we brought the community group back that helped us and a few other people and said, this is what you told us, this is what we've done, are we on the right track? And we made adjustments to our strategic plan. And so we're also working on what's our next step, because we also want to continue with that process. But we also look at how do we find out from the people who walk in our doors if we're doing the right thing or not. And those that we do a lot of surveying. So we started with the experts. So the Rochester Area Foundation actually had a training session where they brought Wilder Research and the Bush Foundation in to do a session on evaluation and using data to help evaluate. And we embraced that. We brought Wilder back in to do a session just with library staff. And we developed this, which is called a logic model, that really helps us look at how do we evaluate? How do we know that people are getting more access to materials and to collections? How do we know that people are improving their knowledge and skills? And so we've developed a framework to make sure we're continuously asking people, are we on the right track? And so to keep this in front of us at all times, over in the meeting room where the library board meets and the administrative team meets, we actually have a data wall. And I wish I could show you the scale of this. It's actually 6 feet by 24 feet. And it really keeps up keeps data in front of us at all times, not only to say how are we doing and how are the programs doing, but also what are the places on that data wall where we need to get ahead of it? What are the conversations the library board has to be having to stay ahead and to keep us moving in the right direction? And so that data wall, so right now that's been up for, we've got data from the second half of 2017, but we will continue to update that on a regular basis. But it's how do we help use data to help us make good decisions. So what are the results? So last year we had over 500,000, almost 520,000 people walk through our doors. Our program attendance, as you can see, just continues to skyrocket. We are bursting at the seams. And that the programs, they just continue, people continue to come in and take advantage of library programs. And we checked out almost 1.9 million items. But what does that really mean? And that's where we get into our outcomes measurement. So 96% of the people, the visitors we surveyed, almost 3,000, reported a positive experience with the library. 83% of our visitors improved their knowledge or skills. And 55% of our visitors surveyed reported increased connections with each other. More than half of the people are building their connections in our community, which strengthens our community. So that's the story through data. At this point, I'd like to share a different story.
I'm James Arnold. You can call me Jimmy, and I use he, him pronouns. I'm an activist, punk rocker, baby librarian, writer, book lover, and seamster. I grew up in Rochester, and I've been coming to the Rochester Public Library since I was very, very small. My, actual involvement with the library in terms of programs started when I was about 13, and I put a suggestion in the suggestion box that was like, can we start a writing group for teens? Librarian sent me an email because I left an email on the suggestion, and she actually thought I was like an adult person, and she was like, well, if you can find teenagers to come to this program, we can have it. And I was like, I'm 15 years old and I can bring all my friends. She was like, oh, so you should join the teen library council. So the rest is history. I did not have a community where I felt at home. I was in a really dark place. I was hurting a lot, and I was so lucky to find a community in the Rochester Public Library. The only person for a long time that called me the name that I wanted called before I had the guts to come out to anybody else and say, this is who I am, this is what's going on.
So James will be accompanying me and our board president to Washington, D.C.
Watch your sweet cat, please. It's okay.
When we go to Washington, D.C. to accept the National Medal, James will be the community member who will be attending with us. Questions?
All right. Comments, questions? Mr. Wojcik.
We are very well aware of how awesome our library is. We are thrilled to death that not only do we love it, but the community loves it just as much. And I appreciate what you're bringing to us this evening. This looks like a tremendous opportunity for the community and the visitors.
Mr. Campion.
Who does all the graphics?
So Nicole Henry, who works on our team.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's such an asset to be able to present a message that's so cohesive on such a few sets of pages. I mean, we're all, maybe I'll speak out of order, but I would say tremendously grateful for the leadership and what the library has put into it. Seeing a strategic plan, I know we've talked about it a number of times, see the strategic plan play out and kind of get into that feedback loop of having a plan, executing it, and taking the result. Going to continue to yield significant results. And the one thing that you hit on that I always remember is I was told that you are what you measure. And so just a fantastic thing to actually be out there measuring the result of what happened. So appreciative of that. Congratulations on significant accomplishment there. One of five libraries being recognized nationally is a really huge achievement and something we're all very proud of the organization for.
And a huge team effort. I mean, the city, the library, the Friends of the Library, the Rochester Public Library Foundation, and the community all coming together.
All right. Anything else? Thank you very much. Yeah, obviously a very positive report, and you have much to be proud of, and
yes,
much for this community to be proud of.
Exactly. Yeah. So, thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right, our next item this afternoon is the North Broadway reconstruction. You might recall that we had a couple of options presented to the council. Some of the council members asked for a third option with some elements changed. And we have a partial diagram in our packet that was included, and I believe some comments from Public Works staff or the consultant. So, Dylan, I'll turn it over to you.
Good, this worked. All right, Mayor, members of the council, thanks for having us this afternoon. As you know, we prepared a third option for North Broadway. 2 weeks ago, we presented our preferred alternative and then another alternative. If we need to pull those up, I had those. That was more in line with some of the comments we received from the businesses along the corridor. Now, with this option, we've drawn up. We took that alternative that we prepared based on opening a few more intersections and added bus pull-offs at the local stops along the corridor, something you wanted us to look at. And so we can, I'm gonna let Aaron talk about not only the bus pull-offs, but also we have some site distance issues to look at with, as it relates to parking, if we were to introduce parking along the corridor. And then also the discussion of turn lanes came up, right turn lanes at some of the more major intersections. So the traffic engineers at Bolton Mink studied both alternatives that we previously presented, and we have I included that memo in your packet. Just talks about the level of service, which is a measurement of how intersections operate, and we can speak to that a little more. So I'm going to hand it over to Aaron.
Sure.
From Bolton Mink.
Just sabotage us to an extent. So the first one here is the bus pull-off idea. This was actually something that we did evaluate in one of our seven alternatives. Understanding that today with that existing kind of wide shoulder, there isn't technically a bus pull-off now, but a bus can kind of slide over to the existing transit stops. We did look at this alternative and evaluate it with a full pull-off, meaning that the bus can leave the lane totally. As depicted here, with the removal of the bike lanes, as was suggested by council at the last meeting, This does allow this to fit within the footprint of roadway that we had originally planned. A couple things to note, we did not like the current condition or keeping that moving forward with the bike kind of sliding over. That seemed to introduce a potential conflict for someone trying to squeeze around a bus and not really have enough of a full lane width. So this was, of the bus pull-off ideas, the one we liked. What was giving them a full 12-foot bay to pull into to keep traffic free flowing off to the side. This was not a favored alternative simply for the reason of, again, one of the outcomes of the study, which was to really focus on this as a future transit corridor. This does have impact on the throughput of transit. When the bus has to leave the lane, especially during rush hours, and has to re-merge into traffic, it slows them down. So a couple of the measures that we evaluated were, you know, total passenger throughput of a bus, the travel time for the bus through the corridor under this scenario was worse than if we let the bus stay in the lane. Does seem to be more of the best practices today. A couple of things have come to the forefront in transit design. One of them is you put the station after the intersection. You don't want the bus to stop before the intersection and then have to, you know, either have a traffic signal while making it stop once it's moving again. And that they really do concentrate now on leaving the bus in the through lane again, so you don't have that yield and kind of merger issue with the passenger vehicles. It is typically yield to buses. That is the rule of the road. I think we know during congestion periods and rush hours that is generally not what happens. People don't yield to buses when they need to come back. Hence, again, why the best practice today has been typically to keep the bus in the travel lane. Dylan, is that a fair summary with kind of how we evaluated this? So it was new to draw this up today to remove that bike lane, but we did already have this concept designed and evaluated as part of our 7 different alternatives we've looked at. There could be a potential based on the final design of these transit stations that there may need to be some more right of way acquired. We don't have the complete transit station layout done at this point, but we did show that there is an option or a potential here on the one side to need a little bit of property there, as noted by that dashed green line. Good to note that there is that potential under this scenario. And again, the idea was to make sure we had a full pull-off. We didn't like the alternative where they were kind of blocking traffic and kind of not blocking traffic. Otherwise, some other traffic data from here. The vehicle delay, this idea of the bus stopping in the through lane and delaying traffic, we did model that with our traffic scenario. The delays on vehicles were pretty negligible, not enough to offset the potential gains again to the bus mobility. And one of the other things we did note as part of the traffic study that we did is current average speeds right now on Broadway are about 39.5 miles an hour. It is signed a 30 mile an hour zone. Some of these things we've talked about last time, I know the council's heard, you know, maybe more urbanizing this section of roadway. Previously was a state highway with the extra wide lanes. Another idea of having buses load in the lane does tend to calm traffic down. It slows you down, and we've got about almost 10 miles an hour average speeds over the speed limit. So I guess staff didn't really think that was a bad thing if that was the case.
Should we talk about parking?
We sure can. We can throw. We did. This was something that we did. We had our graphics folks develop this because you don't want an engineer drawing a picture like this because it's sometimes hard to follow. The idea of parking came up. So this layout shows an 8-foot parking lane on the outside. Same couple block area. We wanted to show a couple highlights here. Number one, typically when you see on-street parking, you do not see private driveways. Driveway accesses to parking lots and on-street parking typically aren't in conflict to each other. You see on-street parking in areas where you consistently have building faces up against the right-of-way where you don't have accesses to lots. On this block, we showed you kind of what that would look like when you have a car sitting on a driveway. Those parked vehicles in that parking lane are obstructing their view. I think particularly in an urban corridor with, you know, the 25 to 28,000 vehicles a day, that's something we would not recommend and not prefer to construct. So one conversation we would like to have is if on-street parking is desired, our recommendation would be that we look at closing those private driveways. Not something that we plan to do as part of the project. It's certainly a lot of businesses have direct accesses to parking lots, are pretty important. I would assume for the well-being of their businesses, we made the decision, the city staff did, and the project management team, that we were not going to pursue those closures. We think introducing this idea of on-street parking does probably require us to go back and look at that again. Those sight lines that we're showing is, and these are even pretty generous, we're showing the car all the way up to the intersection and looking down the street, and as you can see, those shaded areas are obstructed view at the normal line of sight. So this is a pretty unsafe condition, we feel, especially, again, during those rush hour periods where traffic is pretty heavy.
Just a quick comment. Today, we don't have parking in this particular segment.
Correct. There's an isolated area on the south end, on the southbound side, where we have one block of parking. And then, again, there are a couple stalls on the northbound side, just north of 7th Street.
Right. So this would be additional parking that
doesn't exist today.
Mr. Ruskin?
Well, the first place I thought about when you brought this up was South Broadway, between 6th and 4th, heading north. They have that scenario where they have parking along the road and they have driveways into businesses. Correct? So, I mean, you said it's not something that we don't see, but...
Yeah, I think...
I mean, it's the first place I thought about when you brought this up was... They do right there, and so I'm not sure I believe the parking's the right thing, but it seems like we've got it around the community and places on Broadway.
I'm sure there are. I think just an example of showing general practice would not recommend it. I think it just introduces another safety issue. What you would typically do in a scenario like this is you would try to restrict parking in areas directly adjacent to them. You follow those dash lines, so maybe you pull out, two or three stalls upstream of every driveway, and now you're just not getting very many parking stalls in there. If you do that, we have 35 driveways, direct access to Broadway. By the time you put all those holes in your parking stalls, what do you have left? In that block right here, you'd see you probably wouldn't have one to the south of the oral surgery business, or probably up to the Indian Garden restaurant. You might be able to get a couple, I guess, to the north between 12th and the driveway by the laundromat. But when you start pulling those out, now what have you gained was kind of our thought.
And I think just to clarify, and I'm speaking only for myself, in any of the plans, I wasn't looking to add parallel parking on Broadway. Whether we retain the modest parking we have, that's another question. But okay. I personally wasn't looking to add any. Especially for some of the businesses that do have appropriate off-street parking and they're used to using that today. But just a clarification. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I did include that memo on the traffic study. It's pretty technical in detail, but it shows that the level of service with those without the right turn lanes, it still operates at a level of service A or B, which is well above what we'd expect within an intersection. And so we did not include those just because we're restricted by, we only have so much right of way, so there's all these competing needs. So because those intersections are still going to function above what we typically expect, we left the right turn lanes out, and that was our kind of our deciding factor as we were evaluating the different options.
And there are really only two intersections where those right turns really even remotely would justify it. 13th and 7th were the ones that we showed in that memo. And generally, what our traffic model shows is that that level of service, that's a measure of like how long you have to wait at an intersection. What that level of service is really saying is that what actually meters traffic at 13th and 7th are the traffic signals. It's not the right turn lane. The lanes would back up far enough where you wouldn't even be able to get in those right turn lanes anyway during those peak hour periods. Now, when it's not rush hour, traffic volumes are low enough. Again, the traffic signal would do an adequate job, according to our analysis, of letting those right turners make that movement. Again, at 7th Street right now, you really kind of have that kind of right turn lane that people use. Again, if we were to construct something, you would construct a full-width, safer right turn lane that would extend further up the block. And some of those queue lengths we showed you in that table, again, it just, the signal itself is what's going to make traffic flow, not being able to get into a right turn at those volumes. Even at 179 vehicles an hour in the morning, you know, we're approaching three a minute, one every 20 seconds on that southbound direction at 13th. The traffic signal is going to meter that traffic very well. The turn lane doesn't add a lot of benefit to offset what would be potential impacts and costs. I agree, there's a lot of data in there. Sometimes that can be hard to interpret, but traffic engineers like those numbers and letters in tables.
Yeah, again, speaking for myself, I don't see any value in this option. I think that this is the kind of design that we would have expected to see 50 years ago. I think this is the kind of design that signifies to the young professionals that we want to have make their homes in Rochester, that our priorities are not where, you know, our own data suggests that they should be. This makes everyone in the corridor less safe. It makes pedestrians less safe. It obviously makes cyclists less safe because they're losing a protected bikeway. It makes crossing at the intersections in a lot of places less safe. And it certainly makes transit users less safe as well. It's I don't understand this. I don't get this. I think this is... if we want to create the Rochester of 1970, this would be the way to go.
Mr. Campion.
Yeah, I just have some questions. I just want to make sure I use your time as well as possible. So my understanding, and I thought I heard reiterated here, is that the bus pull-offs are not a best practice for a transit corridor. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it does. There's always variables in there. I think what we heard from the city's transit staff and what we've seen implemented in a lot more urban transit corridors like this, that yes, that would be true. The bus in the lane is generally favors that transit mobility. It's better for them. It's better for total throughput of passengers. When you get into high-speed situations, you know, maybe that might change a bit. Again, we're 30 miles an hour. We're in an urban environment. That can shift that best practice to the in-lane stop. If you're in a rural high-speed section, you might look at it because you might want to, you know, people aren't paying attention, people are distracted, you have a higher potential for big-time safety issues. Maybe you would look at a pull-off or a separate station location, but I think based on the city's transit staff's recommendation and what we're seeing implemented elsewhere, that did lead us to that in-lane loading.
So if it's okay, I'll have him just go through a couple of these. Yeah, I heard you say congestion getting into and out of the traffic lane causes significant degradation to overall transit efficiency. Is that a fine way of summarizing what you kind of told me here?
I would guess, we didn't say it was like a significant delay, but in comparison, you know, in our analysis, we said it was probably not favored versus the in lane. We did not go as far as to measure the how many seconds of delay it would
sure.
be. Again, just based on in a rush hour event, you know, you're maximizing the traffic on Broadway. That bus leaving the lane would slow it down.
Okay.
And so, red, yellow, green, you know, comparing those alternatives, you know, this did not get the green light. The green light was the alternative that kept the bus in priority in its lane of travel.
And so, you know, I've seen some other roadways that have gotten redone, and they do put in parallel parking across the entire corridor, which could be something interesting. I mean, that at least sparks to me some ideas of where you can reduce the travel speeds from almost 40 miles an hour on a 30 mile an hour road for the average speed to be 40 miles an hour. I mean, that's pretty concerning. So unless we're not talking, again, I'm guessing it gets pretty impractical when we start talking about closing dozens of street accesses to be able to provide that parking continuity. Can someone kind of explain to me, is that legally going to be a challenge for us to justify closing those? Is it going to be cost prohibitive to come through and have to talk to everyone about closing it? Because really, I only see the parking staying if we're going to consistently do it through the corridor so that it can kind of have a corridor appeal to it that as projects. times to go up, they can count on that parking being available.
Richard, do you want to talk about the driveways?
Well, property is entitled to access unless you acquire it. So unless you have businesses, and again, looking at the what's on the screen here, you have a number of driveways. There's very little parking that could be provided there, again, based on sight lines and just the geometrics of the in the taper in and out of the parking lane. So unless you find a willing property owner who's willing to give up their driveway, which, based on conversations to date, doesn't sound like that's going to go very far, I think it would be just real hit and miss here, and probably that one block that currently exists today would probably be the only location where parking may have some merit there. So, again, I don't think it's not our intent to acquire access rights from any of these properties to close their driveways.
Yeah, so it was really a leading question. I was just trying to get you to the same conclusion I was. So I think it realistically, parking in this corridor is not going to get any better than what it is today. That's already, there's kind of a couple of anomaly spots that have it available. They don't seem to be consistent with a lot of the frontages of the remainder of the corridor. So when I look at it, I just am trying to figure out, like, how do we make this a successful corridor for all the businesses? And I'm hearing that probably this bus pull-off isn't the best way to achieve what we're trying to do with the transit system in this area. So that's all I had. I just want to make sure I...
Yeah, in lieu of adding parallel parking, is I think what you were saying. I have Mr. Bilderbeck, then Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, I just thought I'd let you know that I don't like this plan at all. I don't like the idea of having bus pull-ins, and I definitely don't like the idea of putting cars parking the back of the streets. And I would think that if you want to do the parking, I would bet the concerns we've heard from the business owners along the way is not having access to their property. I would bet that we would have a bigger issue if we decided that we wanted to close all those, let alone trying to acquire them through purchase. So this one just doesn't look reasonable to me at all, the whole plan on layout 3.
Mr. Hickey.
I'm not sure why we keep talking about parking, because if you look at the plan before us, that's not what's in this plan. The thing that I like about this plan, for one thing, it restores more traditional lane widths for the traffic lanes. I think the alternate 2B alternate, I believe, have 11-foot travel widths. There may be a time that a bus and a fire truck might try to get down Broadway at the same time. You know, with a 13-foot through lane and a 12-foot, those are more traditional. What's there now?
We're not changing lane widths. So that includes a gutter. It includes that 2-foot, so it's an 11-foot lane. You have a 2-foot gutter pin. So you give the width on this drawing show to the curb
to
face.
The face of curve, yeah.
On the median, we only have a 1-foot gutter, so it's 11 plus 1. So we're using the state aid 11-foot lane widths.
Well, sure. At state aid, you can go down to 10, too, right?
Not on this sort of corridor.
You typically would have a heavy
transit. But not with the heavy transit.
So I'm saying, in this design, why wouldn't we consider traditional lane widths?
Well, these are traditional. These are the lane widths we've been using on all our projects.
What's on Broadway right now?
Oh, they're probably 13s and 14s, and that's why the speeds are as high as they are, because it feels like a runway.
Yeah. So what I would like to see is traditional lane widths. I do like the bus cutouts. So if your only objective is to absolutely minimize the time that the bus takes at the stop, then sure, this would do it. But if you are concerned about backing up traffic down Broadway, then stopping it in the lane is gonna do that. So it depends what your objective are. You know, we've told the engineers if the priority is to give absolute priority to the bus, then sure. But if the idea is to move traffic through Broadway, then I think the cutouts have the stated purpose. Again, we're not talking about BRT. These are buses where people have to get on, stop at the fare box, fish out change, whatever they're doing. These are not BRT buses. These are local buses. They stop more frequently, and the stops take longer. So I do like that element with the bus cutout. And so I would support this.
Okay. Mr. Wojcik, then Ms. Ruskin.
So
We have zero qualified professional engineers sitting at the dais here, but we've got three qualified professional engineers. Only one of them's probably checked out into retirement at this point. Your recommendation, you gave us a recommendation that the best option before us was alternate 2B. Is that still staff's recommendation?
Yes.
Yeah, we haven't changed our recommendation.
Yeah, that was my understanding too. And you know, I want to speak specifically to Mr. Hickey's point about traditional lanes, which, you know, traditional lanes would actually be much narrower if you went way back. The reason why lane widths are changing, to specifically answer his question, is this is safer. This calms traffic. And it's not an exaggeration to say this saves people's lives. And that's why the professional engineers continue to go down this road. Even if you harbor opinions that are not based in fact, to say otherwise, we have professional engineers who are making it very clear to us. And the safety of all these users should be all of our priority. I didn't want to talk about, it sounds like, you know, maybe there's a couple council members who are interested in this option, but doesn't look like the data or the design is going to carry the day. I do want to talk about option 2B and to a lesser extent option 2B alternate, what the advantages are and some of the positives are. And you know, if I say anything out of turn, I hope that the professional engineers will correct me. But you know, first and foremost, if we believe in health and all policy, which I know is something that our county cares a lot about, alternate 2B is the design for a healthier community, no doubt about it. That kind of design could support dense mixed-use redevelopment, which is something that we all benefit from, and that means it also supports affordable and accessible housing for people living in the corridor. It's important to realize, despite statements of the otherwise, based on the engineering analysis, this is going to greatly reduce traffic congestion, in part because of the ability to help the mode shift towards public transit. Eventually, this will be a BRT corridor, and it's important to realize with that local buses don't actually need to stop on the main roadway. A lot of places, the local buses would stop on side streets. That's certainly an option here as well. One thing that we should also realize is that this supports the DMC mode shift goals, and also the ability to get the number of people that we need into the downtown for a job. We cannot underestimate the importance of having safer crossings for all users, and we get some safety by having more responsible lane widths. But besides for that, we also have the ability to decrease the crossing distances, which you can't necessarily do if you're maintaining turn lanes, and also making safe landings halfway across for pedestrians as well. Both of those make our streets more friendly, particularly to those who don't move necessarily as fast as some of us do. This makes our community more attractive and welcoming. I want to say that there's a lot of great businesses in the corridor, but I look at this corridor and I look at the condition it's in, and I don't believe this is the best that we can do in the city of Rochester. And maybe this is good enough for some folks, but right now today it's not good enough for me. I know we can do better. We know that this kind of redevelopment increases property values. We can look to West 2nd Street to do that. We know that this supports smart transit. We know that this can quickly move people in and out of the downtown. We know, based on the data that we were just told, that this is not going to add substantial vehicle delays, even with the buses stopping in the right-of-way. We know that this is consistent with our most recent planning in the corridor, which would be the 2015 corridor plan, which of course included the protected bikeways. And the protected bikeways in themselves are a tremendous advantage. I understand the benefit of having bike lanes, but I also understand the benefit of having protected bikeways. And some of you have spoken time and time again saying you don't feel safe with the bikes on the road. Well, take this one as a win. This is a path that is physically separated from the road. This is what some of you have been asking for, and this is the opportunity to see some of that. And it fits in without causing harm elsewhere. So I do think that the staff recommendation thought a lot about this. Our professional engineers are clearly moving us in that direction. And I would hope that, you know, for the health, welfare, and safety of the people that we represent, that we would
Mr. Ruskin?
I wanted to mention, too, I don't know why we were talking about the parking. I just think that's kind of muddy in the waters. I don't know that that's a request and makes any sense. So I just assume take that off the table. But how wide is the sidewalks on both sides currently? This is, I don't like this map. Just can't read anything. But
currently, it varies, but a lot of areas, it's probably just a 5-foot walk.
Right.
Where we're proposing with the...
Temple.
Preferred alternative has 7-foot walks.
Okay, but this C, as I'm calling it, 3C,
yeah.
Whatever it is,
yeah.
Has 10-foot.
It does. Yeah.
And
so we were looking
on both sides, which is huge. That's a lot of ability for people to get safely, north and south on a 10-foot wide walk there. So I don't know, to me, I think this is a pretty good setup. It's got a nice boulevard area. It narrows the main corridor some. It's got turn lanes. I don't want the parking on there. The bike or the bus pull-out, you can look at it and say, to me, if they get another block further and somebody pulls the cord, are they going to stop in the right-hand lane? Probably. I don't know where they're going to stop after that. But, there's a lot of things that make sense here, and I want to remind people there's that 10-foot walk on both sides, which gives ample opportunity for people to easily navigate that on foot or on bike to go up and down that area, so without the bike lane. So this makes a lot of sense. I'd like to maybe see all 2B, 2B alternate, and 3 run by the business owners to kind of see what some thoughts are there. I believe we need to listen to them. They're not only, their businesses rely on this. They've got skin in the game based on their future, and also they're also going to be paying a lot of the assessment. So I think that having them understand and kind of have some additional input on these makes some sense to me, but I'm not in favor of the 2B. The 2B alternate has some sense, and this one makes some sense too. So,
if I can comment quickly on the walks, we looked at how could we, without the bike facilities, repurpose some of the space. It could be wider boulevards, and it wouldn't have to be a 10-foot walk. My intuition says if we do build 10-foot walks here and no bike facilities, we're going to have the same issue we have downtown where we have bikes on sidewalks, and that's going to be causing problems for pedestrians, businesses, and we're going to be having that discussion along the Broadway corridor too.
Yeah, see, I don't agree with that because downtown there's a high density down there. Here there's the ability to use some common sense and some knowledge to be able to navigate a 10-foot walk, but there's
Can you back this up with some data? Our engineers can.
I'm here to apply common sense and think about the businesses and the people that are users.
Mr. Bildebeck and Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, I will tell you that I am also not supportive of the alternate 2B, but I have a lot of questions, and the questions maybe can be answered someday down the road, but I'm not going to ask and expect them all to be done here, but I will throw them out. I'm concerned about the assessments. We hear a lot about bike lanes, not bike lanes, what it is in, what it isn't in. We've heard, it's in the comp plan, but if you go back to the bicycle master plan, we don't have it. My question is, are we supposed to use, and this is for staff, and I'm not asking for an answer at this moment, but we talk about when we use the master plans, when we don't. Are they guidelines? Are they drawn in sand because there are places we put them and we use them? And then there's times we say, well, no, that's not exactly what we mean. So I think in a policy decision, not only on this project, but overall projects that we do, if we're going to make these kind of statements and take the time and effort to do master planning, are we going to follow through? And exactly what are we expected to do? We also turn around and we talk, unfortunately, Rochester is so cut up, there's very few areas that you can go from one end to another. Broadway would be one, but there's nothing in here that talks about how would this hook into the loop? Where would it hook in? Would it not? What other paths are around it that it would hook into? So we can see if this is going to have the access and the use that it should. Businesses, holy buckets, talk about, we have issues where we have property owners, but they're not necessarily the business owners. And I'm trying to get out to speak with some of the business owners, but I don't think we've done a really good job of getting communications through to everybody. So my whole concern is that we need to do a better job, especially when we do projects of this size, make sure that we're out there getting the information to them, what the kind of impact this has or not. Like I said, looking at 3, if we were serious about putting parking back in, I really hope we will even consider that. That would be crazy for the business. We don't want to do that. When we talk about the side streets and the traffic, and we haven't gone down there, but as long as everybody's kind of throwing out questions and concerns, that's a concern of mine. Going down through the alleys, even if we made 15-foot alleys, one truck in the alley takes care of anybody else getting anywhere. And so I do have a great deal of concern about traffic getting around. If that happens, then it's going to push the traffic off onto the side streets. And have we really looked at what happens to the side streets? The only business that we've heard about that talks about having needing to have access on Broadway is Kismet. And I haven't talked to them yet. But there's just all kinds of questions that I have about this whole process. And it seems to me we get caught up on bike lanes. And the whole thing, when I look at it, is people want access to their business. So it's a left turn. I don't think anybody really gives a darn about the bike lanes one way or the other, especially when we talk about assessments and they don't have to pay for them. What they're looking at is access to their business. What gets them into their business? What gets them out? They're all very concerned what's going to happen if you cut the access off. I sat down there for a couple hours on different days just watching traffic go by. Not a lot of people looking like they're interested in pulling off to get anything. The difficulty is there's our businesses that people automatically go down and go, oh, it's getting close to lunch, I'm hungry, I'm pulling off to eat. I don't think a lot of people go down there and go, oh, I got a toothache, I should pull into the dentist's office. That's probably not going to happen. So we have the different types of businesses, the different types of needs, and I really think we need to stop and look at how does this plan connect with these groups so that they have the best ideas of what's happening. These questions aren't going to be answered here today, and until I can get them answered, until I can get the time to get down and go through and talk to all these different businesses and the business owners, not the property owners, but the business owners, I'm going to have difficulty coming up with any type of decision. But I do, the big one is we need to think about our policy overall on this council on how do we answer questions and when do we use all these master plans. The question came up during the comprehensive business. Which plans work into this, which ones do not? Look at here we are today, and that's a question that I have.
Mr. Hickey next, then Mr. Walker.
Since the assessments are one of the top three issues, as I understand it, just I want to make it clear, the assessments don't change for any of the options. They're the same for all three. The city has never been able to, and go in the past or probably going forward, recover it's the full value added to the property. So you've adopted, every year you adopt a rate based on the type of zoning that exists for a property. Because it's not the current use, it's the highest and best use, and that's usually dictated by the zoning. So there's a flat rate that's used for whether it's, you know, M1 or B1 or B4 or whatever it might be. And that rate is charged regardless of the improvements because it only, again, it only recovers about 20% of the overall project cost.
Thank you.
All right, I have Mr. Hickey next.
So as you know, it's my ward. You had mentioned that you haven't had a chance to talk to the business owners, but I have, and they want a plan that looks more like option three here. You had also mentioned, I think, that, I don't know if it's easy to get the nomenclature, but you had, it sounded like you were leaning towards alternate 2B, I'm sorry, 2B, not 2B alternate.
I'm not leaning anyway.
Okay. Because if you look on this, if we just take this diagram a little bit to the north, or I'm sorry, to the west, to the alleys.
I don't know if they show up.
Yeah. So that's a lot of the concern. You know, the more intersections that get closed, we're forcing traffic down these 15-foot alleys and into the neighborhoods. And that there's just circulation problems. Again, you can do whatever kind of a traffic simulation you want, but these alleys don't have the capacity to carry large volumes of cars. So the business owners, I haven't heard one business owner that favors closing off access, and they generally want something that's going to provide more throughput on Broadway. I had another question. These lanes are labeled 13-foot through lane and 12-foot through lane, but you tell me they're really 11. I believe on 2B and 2B alternate, they're labeled as 11. So are they really 11, or is that,
yeah,
so
we,
those?
We're not changing.
It's just the way they're dimensioned. So it's 11 plus 2 versus 4, 13. So I apologize for the confusion there, but
All right, Mr. Wojcik next, and Mr. Ruska.
And I'm going to keep pushing that when it comes to the safety of the people of Rochester, we need to listen to professional staff. My dad has a lot of opinions on how you build a road. He also has zero education, and I also don't really care about his personal opinions. I like what professional staff has to say, and if there's data to be looked at, we can look at the data. I think that between 2B and 2B alternate, the principal change between those two is the amount of left turn access. And it's important that we realize that there are many, many stakeholders in this corridor. The businesses are one of them, but there are many in addition to the businesses. And the businesses pay a portion of the project cost, but it's certainly not even the majority of the cost. So everyone's safety and consideration is important to me. I don't care whose ward it is. That's a worthless point to make from the standpoint that I want every citizen to be safe no matter where they go in the city of Rochester. There is no authority or designation or responsibility or special privilege depending on who happens to represent a certain area. And I think there are a lot of cyclists that live in Ward 5 that deserve to be safe as well. A couple of thoughts if we do go down the path of not fully supporting the staff recommendation for 2B. And I think there are some compelling cases to be made as I dig into the area on the alternates. For some places where left turn access perhaps makes a little bit more sense, some places than others. But the first thing with regards to the capacity of the side streets and the alleys and also the avenues that are off, in your modeling, did you show any capacity issues with any of these streets at all?
No. In fact, most of the side streets now, even in the heaviest rush hour periods, have traffic turning movements in the 5 to 20 range. I think the outside of 13th and 7th, where we've talked about those volumes are high. I did jot down a couple of others just so for comparison's sake. At 6th Street, there's 48 vehicles that make that turn in the morning. Again, less than 1 minute. At 11th, there's 31. Otherwise, the rest of them are all in the 20s or teens. To the point of some traffic volume generating businesses, those are the ones I think that we tried to reflect last time, kind of led us down the path of opening up a new alternate and opening up some of those intersections. Those were based on those businesses that we met with and talked to that do have some higher traffic volumes, where they're in the 1,000 plus a day of vehicles that maybe in a scenario where all the accesses are closed, save 3, we would be pushing some more traffic to alleys. Otherwise, we're talking again in that order of 15 an hour in some cases. That doesn't give us pause for impacts to side streets.
And I want to again emphasize the professional staff with the qualifications and the understanding are telling us that the side streets are not an issue. And I appreciate everyone's opinion, but that's who I'm going to go with again on this. I do want to emphasize as well that there are certain places where you can go around and block me to every business. So I, depending on the amount of hardship or business access, I think that changes the opinion for me. But there are some legitimate places that's really tough to go around the block here and get to the business. And one of them in particular would be turning left to the 6th Street, which is where the Dairy Queen is. You literally have to go around like Silver Lake Power Plant to get back to that. So I could certainly support some compromise moving away from 2B if it was targeted and specifically addressed areas that were difficult to access. And that was the one that stood out to me. I mean, most of these areas, it is as simple as going around the block. And I'm not looking to sacrifice public safety when you can simply go around the block to what are mostly, not entirely, but mostly destination businesses. And I understand the fear. I hear fear all the time. I know we've heard a lot from, I've heard from an insurance agent in the corridor who's really afraid of what this is going to do. And I can point to West 2nd Street, where an insurance agent lost left turn access and is still there and just as successful as before. So I do care about access to businesses, but safety needs to be the priority. And the second thing I'd say about moving to the alternate is that if we're going to go to providing more access, one of the things that we were careful to do on West 2nd Street is that at every intersection that didn't have a traffic signal, we made sure that either, for us it's east or west, but here would be north or south, on one side of the street or the other, there was a landing halfway across, which means you can't have the left turns going both ways at those. And that can be done fairly strategically. So even though you have a little bit less safety due to the presence of turn lanes in some of these locations, by simply maintaining the island on either the north or the south side, you still have that pedestrian landing, which makes it much safer and accessible for all users. So I get the consternation, and I think that there's probably a smart way to look at where we can have more access. But if we go down that road too, it needs to be understood that in the future, as this redevelops or as safety issues become aware, we need to make sure we negotiate at this point the right to close those locations at the time where our professional staff deems it's necessary in the future. And that's a good thing to address now rather than kicking the can down the road on it. So I could see going towards the alternate. You know, some people like bike lanes, some people don't. From my standpoint, this isn't a true bike lane because it's a protected bikeway. And there's room for it here. We can accomplish this without hurting any other modes of transportation as such. It just seems like a common sense thing to me that we would accommodate a user safely.
Okay, before Mr. Hickey, just in the interest of time, we're going to want to close this down in about 5 minutes, and it's doubtful we're going to arrive at a solution we all agree on, but we should at least try to give staff some direction on where we're headed or what the next steps might be. So, Mr. Hickey, next.
And in response to your comment, Mr. Wojcik, about not caring whose ward it is, the reason I mentioned that, Mr. Bilibak had said that he hadn't talked to the business owners. My point was, since it's my ward, the business owners have approached me. So in my ward, when people have problems, they feel free to approach me. So that was where that came from.
Yes.
As far as the data, and that only a professional engineer can understand the data. So I believe one of the data points presented at the last COW was that one of the intersections prepared that was recommended for closure had 18 crashes in 10 years for 1.8 crashes a year. And this new design would reduce it by 55%. Which takes us down to what, one crash a year? So again, this emotional discussion about safety, we're talking about 0.8 crashes a year. So that's the justification for the design change. So certainly it's a theoretical improvement, but it's not something that's gonna carry the weight on the overall design.
Ms. Johnson.
Is this a time sensitive matter? Okay, because we want state aid.
Right.
Is that correct?
We would like to deliver the project in 2019 and get started right away. So we haven't even begun final design because we don't have authorization on any of these layouts. So that'll continue to become time sensitive if we keep pushing off a decision. So as I mentioned, our intent was to obviously have this discussion. Hopefully we wanted to bring something back in 2 weeks to the council, but I don't know if we're there yet today.
So what you're saying is we need to make a decision soon.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
So, Mr. Campion.
So I have just a bit of an aside, but I've been trying to keep track of where people are right now. I'll say I'm pretty firmly bounded between 2B and 2BL. That's kind of the range of options I see as being viable here. But I'm happy to kind of work on any specific concerns that come up. There's one critical piece here, and that is I don't want any of the business owners that have made it out to all these meetings and come out to try and make sure that they're understanding the process now to feel like they're being left behind. And so one of the things that I had been reviewing is kind of what happens with other projects of this scale and other projects that go through commercial areas. And one of the projects brought to my attention was what was done in Minneapolis surrounding the laying down of the light rail platform that went through a lot of the commercial districts, had a lot of the same debates we're having, had a lot of the discussions about how does this impact existing businesses, how do we continue to kind of move the corridor forward without leaving the businesses behind. And I think Councilmember Bildebeck hit it right on the head, and he said, you know, we don't want anyone to feel left behind by these projects. And I think the goal is to raise all the boats. We want to raise the boats of the property owners. We want to raise the boats of the businesses. We want to make this a functional corridor for all of the citizens that want to traverse it safely. So I guess what I would maybe do to turn this on its head a little bit is to issue a challenge to our administration a little bit. One of the things I haven't seen being addressed as we've gone through this project is, what can the city do to put skin in the game in this area? And certainly we're going to pay for a part of the assessment, but I'd be very interested to see if there's things we can do above and beyond what we regularly do with the project. One of the kind of ideas is, can we get the pacing down for the project to say, we're going to do this set of blocks, then we're going to do this set of blocks. Can we get it to such a granular level that a business can anticipate when they're going to have restricted or difficult access to their property? Is there a way we can financially get involved to help? I think there's a lot of tools out there. I'm not sure that we've ever leveraged them all before, and I think that there have been other communities in Minnesota that have really led the way with corridor strengthening tool sets that don't just help future businesses that come in and redevelop a plot when you sell, but can also be used to help existing businesses that they kind of struggle with what can be a challenging time in any business when you go through kind of a construction period. I generally think I would like to see our administration come back with some answer about a toolkit we can start to apply for these projects that will get us further down the roadway, that will move these conversations just from what's the road project look like, because we've got spent so much time analyzing three different plans for the roadway, and we haven't talked about the broader strategy, about changing the zoning, about opening up opportunities for redevelopment, about supporting the businesses that are there. So I'd really like to focus on that for the next 2 weeks before we're obviously going to have another stab at this, it sounds like, or however long it takes to come up with a platform of tools we can actually apply to make sure that during this construction project, we don't lose those local businesses. I think that's critical, and I think that everyone should know, looking at the tool set, that we're there to stand alongside them in the trenches as we go through this, and we're going to bring the entire community up. It's not just a plan that's going to come and make the roadway different. That's not the goal. So I think what I'd like the council to do is to maybe winnow it down to being between 2B and 2B alt. It seems like we have some support generally across the council to work in that scope, and then to push our staff and to push our administration to come back with a set of tools that can help us get this project done. Because I understand the anxiety, but continuing to churn like this keeps everyone continuing to guess about what the future of this corridor is going to look like. I think I've seen two really practical options, and we need to work to figure out a set of tools that we can use to make those a reality. That'd be my goal to move this thing forward.
Maybe somewhat along the lines of what Mr. Campion's comment. Now, I don't prefer 2B or 2B alternate. I have some affinity to the third option and maybe some blending there. But maybe to your point, one of the things that has come up is, whatever we aspire this corridor to be and what development we anticipate in the future, it's not going to happen overnight. And so one of the challenges or directions I might offer is, I don't know if there's a way to... There's no disagreement. The road needs to be fixed. There's an opportunity to fix the utilities. That there's no question. But is there an opportunity to phase this in some way such that, and I realize there would be some nominal cost downstream to perhaps add some of the protected bike lanes and so forth, but is there a way to phase this such that we maybe start off with something that approaches more of this option three, but allows us as development starts to happen, because it's a little bit of a chicken and the egg thing, as development occurs over the next few years, and to Mr. Campion's point, give people an idea of what could be coming in 5, 10 years, whatever. Is there a way to phase this? So give us that sort of, because that's where I have probably the most heartburn with 2B or 2B alternate, is that's a pretty dramatic change that we're asking some of the businesses and traveling public to absorb that may or may not be good. So that would be my direction, is I don't know if there's a way to phase this that allows us to start with something that approaches option three, but gets us to one of the other options, whatever you prefer.
So two initial thoughts. One is it will be more expensive. It's doable, but it will be more expensive, and basically you're looking at three construction seasons versus one. Mm-hmm. And I think then, again, as the property owners think about it, and again, our experience in doing this for many, many, many years has been their preferences be in there, get it done, and be closest to have the impact the least amount of time. And what you just suggested now is three different construction seasons. Rebuild the road, then probably come back and build medians, and then a third project would be maybe to add the bike lanes. So that's how I would see potentially a phasing, and now you're looking at three different construction seasons where traffic is going to avoid the corridor. The volume of traffic that's available then to frequent the businesses is down. What we've heard from business owners, again, through many years that we do these projects, is it's the best time for us during a construction project to reinvest in our property. It's the best time for us to reinvest in our property because we're going to be losing money anyway during construction. There's no bones about it, is that revenues will be down during the year of construction. So why not take advantage of that? And basically, if you're thinking about doing a remodel or resurfacing the parking lot or something like that, that will be the time. And that's the lesson we've learned in working with property owners, is kind of gets back to what Nick was talking about, a reinvestment. This is a core development project. It shouldn't be considered just a street project.
Okay. So we've got to wrap this up. So any other comments?
Yeah.
I prefer they be in the form of helpful comments or direction for the staff.
Yeah.
Mr. Bildebeck and Mr. Wojcik.
Yeah, my suggestion, I think what we really want to do is we want to see a way that we can get the left access. The businesses are looking to make sure they don't lose business and they want to get into their facility. So anything we can do to either reassure them that they're not going to lose the business or that we can turn around and make the plan so that they have the ability to get the traffic from both directions, that's what I really think they're looking for. My comments.
Okay. Mr. Wojcik.
Very close to Mr. Bilderback. I wanted to point out, though, that now would be the time to do the safe bicycle infrastructure because it's not going to affect the businesses one way or the other. And it's just it'd be superfluous cost and a lack of safety in the meantime not having them in there today. But I'm counting on my own. I understand there's not the support for option three to make that viable anyway. So I completely agree, though, with some of the phasing. I think that phasing eventually moves us towards the staff recommendation of 2B. But I think we can address some of the access issues in the meantime in a very thoughtful way that looks out for the safety of everyone else, because there are some valid concerns that have been brought up. And so I will be... But I don't see any, at this point, I don't see any reason to change anything from the curb line on out on either side. And I think that the one part that we have to refine, as I understand it, is simply what we're going to do for turn lanes now and in the future.
Okay, Mr. Ruska.
I agree with Councilmember Campion. I think we're down to a couple between 2B alts and 3. I think there are a couple that we can come up with an agreement on that. And I think it's up to us to make a decision now. I don't like the idea of pushing it for a three-year build-out. So, but just the last thing is, you know, these businesses are going to be asked to contribute sizable assessments. And my only thought on that is that I think it's only reasonable that these businesses are in support of whatever project we pick here. So I think that's the biggest thing we got to look at is, you know, we're close on this stuff, but let's come up with something that if we're going to ask... for a sizable contribution, that we have support from the businesses that they are in agreement with the project that's coming forward.
Mr. Campion?
I think the council can do this. Seems like we have three supporters for plan three. Anyone disagree with that? So from my standpoint, I just want to move this forward and make sure we can all start consolidating onto a single plan. So I guess my instruction to staff would be somewhere between 2B and 2BO, and a tool set to come back to us that helps us get skin in the game here to help these local businesses get through this period. So I think there's a ton of options. and challenge them to come back with a system that we can actually apply here. And I think that they have the expertise to do it. We don't need to come up with all the specifics now. And then that project phasing, I think we have to come up with a way that we're going to be able to phase a project very specifically to give the insight to all the businesses that want to work on it. But my ask for the council would be to support some version that's between 2B and 2BL, because that seems like where the support of the council is.
Could I just clarify that? Because the difference between 2B and 2B alternate is really just the number of intersections that are closed.
Like turn rates, right?
Right. Yeah.
I would concur with Mr. Campion. I also support we move in that direction.
We had three people that supported three, and Mr. Bilbeck said he's not prepared to support one yet, so I'm not sure that why we'd want to take that one off the table.
I just think we tell staff, look, again, I think the businesses are looking for the most access they can get. I understand that. What we have to do is look to see what we've done. On Second Street, we put in additional cut-ins in some locations to make it easier for people to get through. Then we got complaints about the tall grass because the natural plantings grew higher than what they could see around. I understand that, but my whole thing would be let staff try to figure this out. You know what the direction is. At the same time, I believe that administration needs to figure out how we use our master plans.
I just want to be clear, though. You're not a supporter of the plan three.
No, he said the parking.
Yes. But so, I also said that about 2B as well.
So perfect. 2B all. Find some variations.
2B and 3.
You know, look, I'm not interested in rehashing this 3. There is not the support for 3. Do we have 4 people on the council that can see that we're not doing option 3? That's, correct me if I'm wrong. Okay, it looks like I'm okay.
No, stop. You don't assume just because someone didn't respond. I am interested in continuing to look at 3. We've seen a partial diagram for our presentation today.
I would support directing staff to no longer consider 3.
I would not. Let's move on for today.
I'd like to get this resolved.
I think that's the trouble here, is like there does not seem to be support, and we're going to continue investing staff resources and continuing to come up with alternates of plan 3 that meet, you know, unspecified goals. I think the rest of the, what I heard was that plan 3 didn't have support, and so let's move on with 2B alt and find some version of 2B alt that meets everyone's expectations, because I think we're pretty close. My point, there's a bunch of other considerations here that are not getting the adequate focus, which is what can we do about all the businesses surrounding the project that needs to take place? We need to do a road project here. What can we do to make that better?
And I guess the issue I have is, as much as some people are opposed to considering option 3, I'm just as vehemently opposed to looking at 2B or 2B alternate. So that's why I think there's some opportunity.
Yeah. Let's do the informal vote here so we can give staff meaningful direction. Otherwise, Mr. Saber, I'd ask you to state back the consensus for option 3. Because my understanding is there is no comfortable direction to pursue option 3 at this point.
Well, the difficulty we have is we don't take votes, per se, so I'm not sure how you want to proceed.
We can use straw polls, nothing wrong with that.
Right? A formal vote tonight if we needed to.
Yeah.
Bring it up tonight.
Yeah, we should bring it up tonight.
Yeah, that's all the right thing.
All right. That way we can deal with it. All right, limited time left, so let's move on. We have the Adolf Bierman House, and Mr. Nygberg.
Yes, sir. Give us the 5-minute version.
Yeah.
I'll be somewhat brief for you. How's that? thank you very much for your time. Since 2011, when I joined Park and Rec, Bierman House has come up as a topic of conversation with various community members, county staff, and city staff. In 2011, the county went and did an assessment condition analysis of the Bierman House. It's a picture from the front cover. Based on that condition, we know that the condition is very bad. Structurally, and a whole lot of interior just renovation stuff is necessary to make that a viable property. In 2018, the county board actually voted to proceed with an RFP process to see who has interest in renovating the Bierman House. Any proposals were on the table. It was up for bids or for review for several months. Park and Rec staff, along with community members, thought about putting a proposal in. We did not do so. We did not put our proposal together in time enough to get that pulled together. And ultimately what happened is there was no proposal submitted for this activity. So there it sat, the county board had to make a decision. What should we do with that beer house? They talked about demolishing the building. They talked about getting rid of it somehow. There's costs to go to do that. They instead had some pressure from community members to go and try the process again. We were then approached to see if we had an interest in this property again to see about renovating it. We had a benefactor that expressed interest in supporting the funding for that, performing the renovations of that, supporting that activity, if we were the kind of lead party to do that. And as part of that activity, then we went back to the park board on the 3rd of April and asked them some basic questions, should we go through with this proposal initiative? And they raised various questions that we had answers to, one of which was the cost concerns. The cost concerns are what city financial dollars would be put into this. And that answer is virtually none on the renovation side. They asked questions, what benefits are there to the park system? We answered culturally, it outlines and is consistent with our park system plan. Environmentally, there's a whole core area that meets our system plan as well. And overall, it was a good thing to have a building that's got historical significance to be renovated again for the community. The other question that was raised by the county by the park board was the issue of long-term sustainability. We don't have an answer to that yet, how that will be operated financially, fiscally in the future. But we do have some ideas. A friend of the Beerman House, a benefactor could come forward to provide an endowment fund to help support that. There's various methods that are proven out there. Plumber House is a good example of that. Friends of Corey Hill is a good example of that. So with that information, we went through, got some confirmation by a benefactor again that they were still interested in that activity, and we submitted an RFP, request for proposal. Ours is a limited no-cost proposal that outlines really the benefactor will cost, provide the funding for this, the cost for that, the renovations for that activity. The county will waive the fees related to the inspections for the building, the septic system, and the well system that's required. We've maintained the abutting core that we've done so for the last 15 years, 20 years, something like that. We take over the grounds remains as well. And once that building is all done renovations, we'll start looking at that long-term sustainability plan, whatever that might be. The picture you have in front of you here, you can see what property we do own in fee title. You can see the area that the county owns, the big, larger tract called the Neighborhood 80 that we maintain on their behalf at no cost to them. And you see the Beerman House in the very lower corner of that property. This ties together with a long-term plan that was developed back in the 1980s that looked at a grander park-like setting for our property, the property we maintain for Olmsted County, and a future natural area further to the west, with the Beerman House kind of located in the very center of this. It's consistent with the land plan they had developed for when they bought the property and acquired it with state funds and lock-on funds. So right now where we're at, the county board is looking at making a decision someplace around May 15th. It'll be before the board. They'll talk about it, whether they make a decision there or not. I don't know that answer. If they do, we'll be notified of that information. We'll then go back to our park board someplace around August 7th with an agreement with the benefactor that lays out the conditions for that project, bonds and insurance, paperwork, things like that. And then after that, that gets approved by our park board, which I'm assuming it will, because there's a no-cost option for that. We go back to the county board for the transfer of the property to the city of Rochester. There's some paperwork to be done with the DNR along with that, and then final transfer will happen someplace around September 15th, and construction will start someplace after that, after the designs are all done. That's basically it in a nutshell. I do have a few pictures here to look at, if you want to see that. That's the current condition of the outside. I got four pictures here, I think, of the outside and one of the inside. Structurally, you can see there's some problems with that itself. I think the rough cost for structural improvements to keep it weathertight is about $270,000. The interior works another $250,000 or thereabouts, so about $500,000 project. This is probably one of the better conditions of the picture of the inside. There's worse pictures that are out there as well. Overall, I guess we think it's a value to the community, a value to our park system to have this in place. And look for your support in this.
Okay, so I'll start off just, I will say I'm not particularly warm to this project. One, we know we've got a potential benefactor, and I appreciate that. I think the cost beyond will probably exceed that. Plus, we haven't talked at all about the ongoing costs, staff time that would be involved. I think as a city, as a council, we're already trying to be continually obligated to two fairly large projects in the form of Cascade Lake and now Game Haven. This particular property, I realize it's on county land, but this particular property isn't on any of our HPC lists that I'm aware of, and we all know we're not probably paying enough attention to those properties that are on the list, short of trying to take on another project. What's appealing is that the alternate proposal potentially not only renovates and preserves the structure from a historical standpoint, but puts it back on the tax rolls. And I think there's also an opportunity to potentially work with whoever the property owner might be to still have some access to the trails or some of the ancillary land. So I'll stop there and see if others have comments. Mr. Wojcik.
This is a part of the Mayo Historic District, if I'm not mistaken, which is already on the National Historic Register.
I believe so.
Yeah. And the with the benefactor, it would stabilize the property, right? There's no further action required.
Actually, the benefactor would pay for the entire restoration, stabilization of the structure itself, plus renovation of the inside.
I don't know what the other offer is, but what a tremendous win for the public, then. I'd be supportive of moving forward with this.
Other comments?
And Mike, what this comes in front of you said the county board went?
May 15th.
And my understanding is there is another person now buying for that?
There's two proposals that have been submitted. I do not know the details of the second proposal. I've heard hearsay of what that entails. Mr. Ruska had talked about it briefly. That's all I know.
Okay, so you don't know who the person is?
I do know, but I'm not confirmed that who it is.
Is there some way you could have a discussion with them? Because I would, for you to continue what you're looking to do on the park end of it, maybe that's a piece of property or a portion of that property they're not interested in, the trails.
The trails itself, let me go back to that picture. We already manage the county 80 acres roughly for the county itself, and we've done that for years. That will not change. The Beer House property is about 1 acre in size, and it's a little yellow piece right down there. So the county actually owns the blue area on the screen right there. We own the yellow. Those two will not change in that process unless the county decides, yes, they like the proposal. They'll give us that blue area. The Beer House itself, the request for proposal was just for that 1 acre parcel plus the house. So the other proposal really does not have any benefit for us other than it ties the whole quarter project together.
Okay, anyone else? Mr. Campion.
I remain kind of concerned about seeing a sustainability plan for this project. So again, the CapEx cost is great to have for the benefactor, and I'm not at all trying to diminish the gift that they'd be giving to the community. But I think I saw an estimate of about $15,000.
Rough number of operational costs. You got electricity, you have some planning ahead for a future roof replacement, things like that, long-term issues like that.
So, you know, unless there's a, you know, clear plan for if this property is turned over to rentals, I saw was one of the options, or some different options for how it would be used or sustained by an organization like that, I really feel like a little bit more flushing it out of that is in order before we take on a liability. Because one of my ongoing concerns about this is, you know, it was kind of a heated thing, and I saw a lot of deliberation about removing a potentially historic building and having to tear it down. And I certainly don't want that just transferred as a liability to the city to then have to make those sorts of hard conversations over and over again about whether or not this is a going concern about the function of the property. So I can come along, I think, on this if we have all of our I's dotted and T's crossed, but I just would ask that we have a little bit more investigation into, you know, is the county going to join us in that long-term sustainability plan? I think, from my perspective, you know, we're doing them a pretty big service by taking on a liability they really didn't want to have to deal with anymore. Even demolition was going to cost a couple tens of thousands of dollars to demolish it. So, you know, to me, I think there's plenty of opportunity here to get some partners on board to line up some of that before we have to go sign on a dotted line and make this a reality.
I had a quick procedural question for the city administrator. Let's say that this goes forward, and let's say the county board accepts the city's proposal. Does it come back to the council at all, or is this a park board decision?
It's a park board decision. The way we've got it planned out right now is that the park, or the county make a decision. We'll then put together our agreements with the benefit factor that outlines the cost, outlines his bond insurance to make that guarantee Mr. Camby talked about, make sure that project is viable. If he can't, that person can't come up with the funding or can't come up with the bond insurance, he can't commit, we can't commit, the project goes away. So we don't go to step two until we have step one done. If we go back to step two, the agreements put together goes to park board for that authorization and that approval.
Okay, Mr. Ruska. Then Mr. Wojcik.
I guess, Mike, I'm really glad to see us doing something to preserve this area, this facility. I'm concerned about the city taking it on. You know, the thing we always hear from the park department, we don't have enough funds, we don't have enough manpower, and now we're taking on this. It seems like there's another alternative out there. So I guess I'm wondering if, I think you said you have up to, you said $500,000 that a donor is giving to refurbishing this facility, right?
They'll coordinate the activity, the refurbishment, the renovations, the actual fees, so it'll be in excess of $500,000, yes.
What happens if it comes in at $800,000? Are we on the hook for anything more than what?
No, the benefactor will be doing everything.
Okay, because I want to make sure if it's done, it's done right, and it certainly seems to me that there's other options out there than us taking this on, so I'm a little leery of it. I think we've got, you know, lots of things that we have, the plumber building, and Randy had talked about a few other places, parcels that we're taking on, so... I'm not sure why we're doing it. Can you explain to me a little bit about what you said it has to do with the trailhead? What's the value in looking at that map where that house is compared to everything else?
So the overall plan that the county had initially on when they acquired the property was to start a grander scheme on a park in this area, a bigger nature park. It was all over the river corridor, the Mail River Lake area, etc. And the Beerman House was going to act as a trailhead location, branching out in both directions to go down that trail corridor in the natural area. How does this impact on a park system plan? Is that is an environmental quarter? Is culturally significant, which is what we're important to look at from our perspective. That's the two biggest things right there. Place to meet people, again, public access to both culturally and environmental significant areas. I can tell you that if the county decided they did not want to give us 80 acres along with us, we step away. That's part of the link that we have to make this a connected project.
Is there a chance you'd take the 80 acres and then RFP the house after that?
That's part of the proposal with the county. That was not part of the concept, no. One thing that we kept looking at here is the public access after renovation was available. And again, whether that is as a small cafe or coffee shop, or whether it's what's called a curatorship, where they open the building up like Plumber House and have tours and information about the building and the property. The idea here, too, is to have a greater heritage park concept, historic district park scenario where, you know, whether it's Mail's property to the north of that would open up the greenhouse areas periodically, or the Mailwood Mansion obviously is right there next door that would have public access. So, again, it's part of the greater park concept.
All right. It makes sense.
Mr. Wojcik.
Yeah, I was a little bit, well, my early support part about that was this went to the park board, right?
This went to the park board.
Yeah, this is the park board is supportive. This is part of their oversight.
Yeah, so this went to the park board as a concept. Submitting at the RFP, knowing that the details are not flushed out at that point in time because the benefactor was not on board totally.
Okay.
The benefactor is now on board. We'll go back to the park board. If the council, if the park board and the county say, yeah, we're good to go, they'll have a chance to reaffirm that decision. So
I don't want to get too much into micromanaging the priorities of the park board because my park board member would also be a lot if I do that. But I do want to say that just merely having bathroom facilities in this location, lining up with our trail, would be fantastic. And but I think Mr. Campy is right that, you know, come back, you know, with a full sustainability plan, but this seems like a tremendous gift to the community.
Now, in reality, we only have a sustainability plan for quite some time. Again, not knowing what that full renovation cost is going to be, how we're going to operate that in the long-term future, we don't have that answer yet.
So I wanted to clarify something you commented to Mr. Ruska. The potential benefactor is $500,000, and Mr. Ruska asked what happens if it goes above that, and you said that the benefactor would stand all the cost.
Right, so the benefactor...
beyond $500,000.
So let me clarify. The benefactor, we talk about rough numbers here based on the county information. $263,000 for the rough stability, another $250,000 or thereabouts for the renovation. That's the cost we've been working under, so that's $500,000. If it comes under or over that dollar amount, the benefactor has told me they will commit to get that renovation completed.
And And I think the reason I ask that is because anyone who's ever renovated a property like this, you don't know what you don't know until you start getting into the foundation and peeling the walls back. So that could easily go above the 500. That's
I can tell you, the person that we're dealing with is very knowledgeable on construction activities in Rochester.
Right. Mr. Russell?
I guess that, again, I'm on micromanage, but like, do we have that in a contract? Agreed upon contract, signed, and everybody agrees that it's going to be whatever it takes to get it done?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
That's our goal.
Okay.
If we learn otherwise, we will not be bringing forward any contracts to the park board or anybody that doesn't have that.
Because I want to make sure it's done right. I mean, I don't want to, you know.
Correct.
We
don't want to go in here saying, okay, now I'm only going to this dollar amount. Now city come back and step in. That was not what we signed up for.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
All right, so it's going to be brought, it's ultimately the county board that'll make the next decision, but then we go from there.
Correct, yeah.
Okay. Anything else on that topic? Great, thank you. For the Ethical Practices Board annual report. Fortunately, I think this will be brief. We have the report in our packet.
Yes, you have the report. And I'm going to do a quick review. The Ethical Practices Board for the City of Rochester is a totally independent board with the members appointed by the president of UMR, the president of RCTC, and the chair of the county board association, the lawyers association, whatever it's called. And so the board is totally independent. We've been very busy this year, as you all know, and we submit our report for the year with our thanks to Terry Atkins, who retired as city attorney, and we welcome Jason, the new city attorney, and thank Jody Colton for her help. Thank you.
All right, any questions? Thank you for sitting with us. All right, any other business for this afternoon? If not, we will stand adjourned and we'll see everyone in a couple of hours.